I think we'll go ahead and get the afternoon session kicked off. It's always a little tough right after lunch. But we've got another series of great talks lined up for you all. We'll have two talks, and then we'll have a break, and then a couple more, and then a question and answer. So it should be a nice afternoon. So I'd like to welcome Dr. Kroos back to the podium to discuss pancreatic and duodenal trauma. Dr. Kroos.
Thank you. I think we have the answer to which is worse, whether it be the last one before lunch or the first one after lunch. It's pretty clear. I have no conflicts to disclose. Well, I take that back. There's, you know, for any of y'all that have been to Memphis, this is barbecue. This is what real barbecue is, right? This is real barbecue. That's the big green egg that's in my backyard, cooking a shoulder. This is probably the best barbecue in town, this place called the Cozy Corner. This piece of plywood has been there for years. It's covering up these panes of glass that are broken there right behind the open sign. It's been that way for years. I don't know if they'll ever fix it, but it's pretty good. But you can probably only go there during the daylight hours. Because it's in a neighborhood where we get a fair amount of our patients. But that's what barbecue is. This is not a barbecue. This is not barbecue. Okay? That's not barbecue. Barbecue, not barbecue. Okay? So we're going to spend the next little bit talking about duodenal and pancreatic trauma, and we'll separate it, for the purpose of this talk, we'll separate them out, but as you well know, that they're frequently combined because they're so close to each other. Some say that the pancreas, in fact, is the most fickle organ in the body. It lies in the bed of the stomach. It's cradled in the arms of the duodenum, but it gives its tail to the spleen. So duodenal injuries in general, not particularly common, about 5% or so of all trauma laparotomies. Some of that is because patients sort of select themselves out before they make it to the hospital, especially following penetrating injury, because of the large named vascular structures that all live right around the duodenum. Predominantly follows penetrating injury, and it's got pretty significant morbidity and mortality associated with it. And if you look at there's been a fair amount published, at least in earlier years, about morbidity and overall management of duodenal wounds. Not really a whole lot recently, because people have sort of worked it out, but very important work done by Harlan Stone, who used to be here in Phoenix, and Tim Fabian, he was a fellow at Emory, about duodenal decompression and twin tube ostomies, and they really were the first ones to drop the duodenal fistula rate from fairly significant numbers to less than 1%, and that's where they would put what they originally described were three triple ostomies. They would put a gastrostomy in, an afferent, and efferent jejunostomies. The afferent tube was for internal drainage of the duodenum and internal decompression following duodenal repair, and then an efferent tube for jejunal feeding. By managing these penetrating duodenal injuries that way, they were able to reduce the overall fistula rate and also drop the mortality rate, but importantly, drop the fistula rate to below 1%. This was done back in the 70s during the work at Emory, and it remains a mainstay of therapy for penetrating and blunt duodenal injuries today. It's a penetrating duodenal injury is an operative diagnosis. There's no need for a CAT scan, there's no need for an upper GI, there's no need for anything except for an operation, okay? And usually you need anesthesia with that, although sometimes, you know, if they decide to show, if they're done with their Sudoku, then that's okay too. But otherwise, the patient goes to the operating room and you get a thorough exploration of the duodenum, not just peeking at it and say, okay, it doesn't look too badly, I'll mobilize just a little bit. You've got to look at all four parts of the duodenum, explore the lesser sac, and all hematomas in the epigastrium should be explored. All hematomas following penetrating injury in the epigastrium should be explored, okay? Even if it's not expanding, penetrating injury, explore those things. Now, this is what happens. This is what it looks like. This is what a duodenal injury looks like after it's been there for a couple days when it's missed. In the interest of full disclosure, this was not my case. Just want to be crystal clear about that. I had the fortune of reoperating on the guy and found this injury because he was doing very poorly, as one may examine, or as one may expect. There's sort of rotten edges there and a bunch of misery around the duodenum itself. So for a duodenal exploration, a wide Coker maneuver, and a Coker maneuver is not complete until you can visualize the left renal vein. So that means you get the duodenum and the head of the pancreas up in the air and visualize the left renal vein. That way you know that you've exposed the entire duodenum. You may or may not need to do a right medial visceral rotation. It depends on what you find. If there's an associated vena cava injury, typically that's best exposed by taking down the right colon and taking down the small bowel mesentery at its base, reflecting it all up, putting all the guts up on the chest, and you've got a beautiful view of the entire retroperitoneum, most of it anyway. Certainly enough to where you can fix the vena cava or fix the renal vein or whatever it happens to be. And if you need to, then mobilize the ligament of Treitz. It's pretty simple to do. It doesn't take very much. But again, you must inspect the entire duodenum. And this is just some graphic of that inside the lateral peritoneal attachments. Rotate. This is there's hepatic flexure. If you're going to do a medial visceral rotation, then you need to flip that up in the air. And this is that patient that I showed you earlier. There's the missed injury of the duodenum. And then because it continues to drain pancreatic juice and bile and whatnot, that's when you wind up with a cake of omentum. You know, the omentum is really your friend. It can really get you out of a lot of bad situations. If this omentum was caked down over this hole trying to seal it, but even the omentum can't do everything. So what are our options when we identify a patient who's got a duodenal injury, regardless of mechanism? What are the options? So it really comes down to these four options here: primary repair, exclusion of the duodenum, a jejunal patch, or pancreatic duodenectomy. And so we'll go through. The jejunal patch is not really used very much anymore, but should be in your armamentarium if you've got a complex injury that you're able to get closed. But if you're worried about the suture line, then you can bring up a piece of jejunum and patch it on there. But again, that's what the omentum is for, and usually the omentum is very helpful when it comes to that. For a period of time, tube duodenostomies were popular, and that's where one would repair the duodenal hole and then just put a decompressive tube in through the duodenum to decompress the duodenum. And again, it sounds like a pretty good idea, but unfortunately, these things should be reserved for the Smithsonian because it's a fistula maker. So really, when this tube comes out, you've got a duodenal fistula. And for those of you who have taken care of patients with duodenal fistulas, you know that that's pure misery. You're better off, you know, sticking needles in your eyes or something. But it's very difficult to manage overall with skin breakdown, electrolyte abnormalities, and the like. So tube duodenostomy, no. But afferent jejunostomy, fed back up this way, that's good. And we'll get into that in just a second. The afferent tube goes into the proximal jejunum, and that way you can tack the jejunum up to the abdominal wall, just like you're putting a feeding tube in. So afferent and efferent tubes go in. We don't put gastrostomy tubes anymore. Use a nasogastric tube for that. But afferent and efferent tube jejunostomies, that will decompress the duodenum, allow for enteral nutrition sooner than the patient's ready to eat. Typically, we will, depending on the complexity of the wound, we will leave the afferent tube to drainage, gravity drainage, for about 5 to 7 days. And then again, depending on the complexity of the wound, we may do a gastrographin study where we just squirt some gastrographin into the afferent tube and see if it leaks. If it leaks, then we got a problem. If it doesn't leak, then we clamp it and then give the patient a hamburger and see how they do. And if they do well, we give them more and then let them go home. But usually the speed tests have given them a hamburger. That works pretty well. That separates out those that are going to leak and those that aren't. But at any rate, afferent tube, as a practical point, I use a 16 French red rubber catheter and cut extra holes in it, okay, just to help drain the bile and duodenal secretions. And this is what it looks like. Bring them out through a side incision. Now, we have sometimes, and for reasons that have always remained unclear to me, to some people, these tubes look like handles. I don't really understand why they look like handles. To me, they don't look at all like a handle, but apparently they do to some people. Also, despite we always would label these afferent and efferent, apparently that's at times unclear. So now we label them feed me and drain me, because that way we get it right about half the time. No, I'm kidding about that. It's probably about three quarters of the time. But it's important that these tubes be labeled properly, because you don't want to start feeding the afferent tube, for example. Now, for more complex wounds, we implore pyloric exclusion. And the pyloric exclusion, I think, is a pretty good way to manage more complex duodenal wounds, excluding pancreatic injuries, okay? I'm not talking about ampullary injuries. That's a separate class in and of itself. But if for a patient who has a large injury, or even maybe a piece of necrotic duodenum a small piece that you have to resect, or I've included patients who have injuries to the medial wall of the duodenum along the C-loop. Why? Because you can't get to those, right? You can't mobilize. You can't separate the duodenum from the head of the pancreas, because if you think, then you'll take the blood supply, and then it's doomed to failure. So when I have a patient who has a trivial pancreatic injury but an injury on the medial wall of the duodenum, I now do a pyloric exclusion on them. We've had pretty good results with that. Now, a couple of technical points about the pyloric exclusion. You know, you fix the hole, do a distal gastrostomy, reach in through the gastrostomy, find the pylorus, and grab it with a Babcock, and then put, I use a 2-0 PDS. That's what I use. And just put a purse string right in the pylorus, tie it, and be done with it. There are some that say that you can fire a stapler across, a non-cutting stapler, across the outside right at the pylorus. In my N of 1, after 4 months, that never opened up, because I thought, well, it's similar to what Dr. McGrath was talking about earlier, or maybe it was Dr. Johnson. Anyhow, when you come, you're a brand new faculty member, you know, you think you know pretty much everything there is to know, and this is mainly geared toward the residents. I can also tell you that I killed the first two people that I operated on, I thought, well, okay, I'll just staple this across. It'll open up in 3 weeks or so. I won't need to do a gastrojejunostomy, because the guy's got a feeding tube. It never opened, had to reoperate on him. He had an open abdomen. It was a mess. But he finally left eating hamburgers. So my suggestion is, don't use the stapler. Kind of a long, drawn-out story to get to that. But don't use the stapler. Sew the pylorus with a purse string shut, and then through your gastrotomy, and then do your gastrojejunostomy. Also through this, I'll feed an afferent jejunostomy through this and still put an efferent feeding tube in as well. So for complex wounds and for wounds on the medial wall of the duodenum, we do pyloric exclusion. Now, for a wound such as this, I mean, this was a patient who had a blunt injury, and that's usually what they look like. The blunt injuries are usually pretty big. They're not little 22 handgun injuries. These are usually somewhat disruptive. So debride it, and then that patient would certainly get twin jejunostomies. Now, we looked at our experience with these. Had about 60 patients who had duodenal injuries, typical urban population, young and otherwise fairly healthy. Most of these following gunshot wounds. We don't see very many shotgun wounds anymore. I don't know how y'all are out here, but shotgun wounds used to be pretty popular in Memphis. unfortunately, I think the weapon of choice has gone to like AK-47s and the like. So we're seeing a whole lot more high velocity injuries. But I digress. At any rate, so typical urban population. Overall mortality is 16%. Most of the deaths occur due to exsanguinating hemorrhage because of the named structures that live nearby. But if the patient survived for 24 hours, then they didn't die, at least in our hands. As far as the injury location, as one would expect, most occur in the second and the third part of the duodenum, just because those are the most exposed. Typically, people who are shot through the first part of the duodenum will wind up with major vascular injury, and then those patients do poorly. Same may very well happen with the fourth part of the duodenum, but again, the majority occurred in that second and the third part. A third of the injuries involve more than one segment. Now, again, as I mentioned earlier about how we like to classify as many things as possible, AAST, the American Association for the Surgery of Trauma, has come up with a classification for duodenal injuries, graded 1, not very bad, through 5, really bad. 2, 3s, and 4s are all in between. But as you can see, with increasing grade of injury, we have increasing complexity of repair. So we looked at actually our repair technique by the injury grade. And as one would expect, with low-grade injuries, almost all of those were amenable to primary repair. But then as we increase the severity of injury, we see more complex methods of repair. Not particularly surprising, but sort of interesting to look at anyway, until finally the grade 5 injuries, there's a very small number, but nonetheless, those patients have pancreatic duodenectomies. As one would expect, there's a reasonable number of complications that occur postoperatively, most commonly intra-abdominal abscess, and then some other minor things such as atelectasis and the like. So I'll leave you with this algorithm for the management of patients with duodenal injuries. If it's a gunshot wound, it involves less than 25% of the wall primary repair. If it involves greater than 25% of the wall, then twin gauge anastomies. If you've got tissue loss or the repair requires tension, which, as you know, repairing anything under tension is bad, or if there's a medial wall of the duodenum, then those patients undergo pyloric exclusion, plus or minus a serosal patch if necessary. Okay, for patients with blunt injury, all those patients get twin gauge anastomies, unless they have tissue loss or tension, and then those patients undergo pyloric exclusion. So it's a simple algorithm, but it really works pretty well, and it's all measured based on the complexity of the injury. And really, a pancreatic duodenectomy should only be done acutely if the dissection has, if the injury has done the most of the resection. So that really the pancreatic duodenectomy sort of turns into a resectional debridement almost, with the exception of reconstructing and that sort of thing. In those instances, frankly, we will, since usually those patients are, they almost always are 20 years old with tiny common ducts, we'll use the gallbladder as a conduit, which makes it technically about 8 gazillion times easier. Then if it obstructs eventually, then you can always go back and then you can sew to a dilated common duct. But using, you know, if they're not shot in the gallbladder as well, then using the gallbladder as the conduit for bile is much preferable. Now, let's talk a little bit about pancreatic injuries. A lot of morbidity, a lot of mortality associated with pancreatic injuries. Mortality up to about a third, and about half of these patients will develop some sort of complication following their injury. And there's not really any big consensus on how to manage these particular patients. A number of options, if we identify whether or not the patient had a pancreatic duct injury, and that's really what it comes down to, is that if the patient has a duct injury or if they don't have a ductal injury. So how do we figure out if they have a ductal injury? Well, you can do intraoperative pancreatography. I don't know if anyone's ever tried that in the acute situation for trauma. It's pure misery, right? Talk about sticking needles in your eyes. You're better off ripping your fingernails off. That would be more fun than trying to do intraoperative pancreatography. ERCP, I don't know what it's like here, but I can tell you that at our institution, it's pretty much impossible to get an ERCP after 3 o'clock or so, maybe two. Or option C is to actually operate on the patient and look at the pancreas. Okay, that's the one that we've chosen because it's the easiest to do and really adds nothing. The others don't really add anything. One of our former fellows, Pat Patton, who's now in Detroit, actually looked at 120 patients who had pancreatic injuries. We drain all injuries, use closed suction drainage, all injuries that are proximal, okay, so proximal to the vessel or to the right of the vessels, all those patients get drained. They don't get big resections, they get drained. So injury to the head of the pancreas gets a drain. Distal injuries, if you think there's a ductal injury, we do a distal resection. If we don't think there's a ductal injury, we drain them. Okay, it's a pretty simplified algorithm. And here it is. For a proximal injury, if you think they have a duct injury, doesn't matter, they get closed suction drainage. If they have a distal injury, if you think they have a duct injury, well, if they don't, then they get drained. If they definitely have a ductal injury, they undergo distal pancreatectomy. We used to try to spare the spleen. It takes too long, it's just not worth it. So now we do distal pancreatectomy, splenectomy. The problem is this intermediate group, whether you're not sure if they have a ductal injury or not. If there's a low probability, they get a drain. If it's a high probability, they get a distal resection. So the intraoperative indicators of ductal injury are here. If you look at the injury itself and you can see the duct, the inside of the duct, then that's pretty good evidence that there's a ductal injury, right? That's one of those that you can sort of take to the bank. So this is a ductal injury. If it's a distal injury, I'm going to resect it. If it's proximal, it doesn't really matter. I'm going to drain it anyway. If the pancreas is completely in two, which is typical following blunt injury, then I think you can be pretty well sure that there's going to be a ductal injury. If you've got a laceration of greater than half of the gland itself, then there's probably going to be a ductal injury. If it looks like somebody took a hammer to the pancreas, then there's probably going to be a ductal injury. Or if you look and you see this clear fluid that continues to leak out of where the laceration is, then again, that's a pretty good indicator. We're not very smart in Tennessee, but these things that we can figure out, and these are easy to figure out at 2 o'clock in the morning. Okay, so that's with that being our algorithm that Pat Patton actually came up with, you know, we came up with that algorithm, we thought, okay, let's see if this works. We had 250 patients, 35 of them died, and then this was the breakdown for proximal and distal injuries. So we compared the previous study, which was when he came up with this particular algorithm, to the next several years where we actually followed this predetermined algorithm to see if this works or not. So this was a breakdown of the patients, again, that of a typical urban trauma center. You can see 24-hour transfusions. You know, these people are getting 8 to 10 units of blood. So these are pretty significant injuries in this particular patient population. Of 123 patients who had distal injuries, it was clear that 28% did not have a ductal injury, or 28 of them, and 29 of them clearly, based on one of those five reasons, clearly had a ductal injury. So that left 66 patients that had indeterminate injuries, and half were low probability and half were high probability based on our criteria. So then they were managed according to the algorithm. And these were the absolute numbers for proximal distal drainage and then distal resections. If you look at the overall complication rate is exactly the same for proximal drainage because that's always what we did, right? That never really changed. It was only after really focusing on what was going on in the distal gland as to whether they underwent drainage or distal resection. And so then by following the algorithm, we wound up draining fewer and resecting more, which left us with fewer complications such as pancreatic fistulas, as in with the previous study where, you know, where we perhaps drained a patient who clearly had a ductal injury that we just missed, okay? So really what this shows is that, as you can see, that in the previous study there were more pancreatic fistulas, even though that number is not statistically different. It's twice as high. So we think that by following this algorithm, then that can reduce the morbidity and then reserve resection for the appropriate patient who could probably benefit from a distal resection since they have a ductal injury. Almost a difference in mortality, although that's probably just more of a measure of severity of injury. So, as you can see in this sort of discussion of both pancreatic and duodenal injuries, it's nice to keep things simple. And I don't know if any of y'all, do they have crawfish here? Because pancreatic wounds really are like eating crawfish. I mean, they're exactly like eating crawfish. You eat the tail and you suck the head. That's how you eat crawfish. That's how you manage an injured pancreas. Okay. So, in summary, then, primary repair for the overwhelming majority, really, of duodenal wounds, plus or minus decompression, depending on whether or not 25% of the wall or whether it's a more complex injury itself. Pyloric exclusion should be reserved for these more complex wounds. Proximal pancreatic injuries can safely be managed with drainage alone. And for distal injuries, you base the decision based on the defined criteria about whether or not there's a ductal injury. If there's a ductal injury, distal resection. If there's no ductal injury, then closed suction drainage. So it's very much like the band KISS. Just keep it simple. That's how you manage these patients. Thank you very much.